Thank you. I'd like to start by thanking Devashish and the other organizers for putting this session together. So I'll be talking about the status of genetic risk prediction in the post-GWAS era. And I will start by thanking, as you know, Colin mentioned, that no research is done actually by yourself. It's a really a team effort from a lot of people from my own branch, my division, as well as from many other institutions and collaborations. Just some some general overview that that why do we want good models for risk predictions? They could be useful for individual counseling, like to weighing risk and benefits for various preventive interventions, like your recommendation for screening for various cancers or medications or intervention for risk factor modification. And so these are at an individual level, but at a population level, we might want to understand what is the distribution of risk for a country like US that might help us the public health officials to develop strategies for disease prevention at the population level. And there are various other applications like comparative effectiveness studies and design of intervention trials and many other things. And so just to keep a couple of ideas, key ideas in mind that, the model to be useful, then it should be well calibrated, and it has to have some power for discrimination. And these are two separate distinct concepts. So calibration relates to a statistical concept of called unbiased estimation of risk. Like, given a set of risk factors, you want to first make sure that you are producing unbiased estimate of risk for people in the population given the given that set of risk factors. And then discrimination is that the ability of the model to explain the disease or trait variation in the population. And that relates to the concept Colin was mentioning, that your risk model or the risk score needs to have enough variation in the population to be able to do that. But notice that this comes first, that your model needs to be well calibrated, because otherwise you might overestimate or underestimate risk for people, and you might make a wrong recommendation about screening or medications. But a model might be very well calibrated. Like, for example, if you are trying to produce estimate of risk of breast cancer for a US woman, you might be able to just use the overall rate for breast cancer from NCI Cancer CR Registry. Like, suppose 13% is a lifetime risk. That's an unbiased estimate of risk, but it does not give any discrimination because everybody's risk is the same. So you cannot discriminate people like who are at high risk or lower risk. So to be able to improve the discriminatory power of models, we need to identify new risk factors and potentially strong risk factors, and that's how we can potentially improve the performance, the discriminatory performance of the models. So as an example, I will just mention, for example, when the results from the, in 2007 or 8, when the, the results from some of the early genome-wide association studies came out, there was a number of people studies the potential utility about say 10 common SNPs, or in this case 7 common SNPs, to discriminate the breast cancer risk in the populations, and they found that the discriminatory performance of those early SNPs, which was again handful of SNPs, 7 or 10, they had very modest discriminatory ability to discriminate who will develop the disease in the future versus not. But since then, the genome-wide association studies has, the sample size for genome-wide association studies has rapidly grown. It has now, for a typical disease like common breast cancer, the sample size has now become tens of thousands, and this was in thousands. And so we made, for example, some projections. We developed some tool, power calculation tools for prediction. That is, and that, under some models for genetic architecture, that means how many, SNPs might be involved into the risk of these different cancers and different common diseases. Let's, for example, in this case, type 2 diabetes. And so we said, that at that time we were doing the calculation around 2012 or 13. If we say that, if we take the largest genome-wide association studies, and if we look at the SNPs that would be achieved genome-wide significance at that largest study at the 10 to the minus 7 level, this is the discriminatory performance of the model you expect. And that's sort of, you know, that has been empirically also observed. It's a modest AUC, again, 57%. And then you also made projection, like, for example, if you want more liberal threshold, but you optimize using some kind of penalized regression techniques, and then you will improve the performance of the model, but not by that much. But what would happen is that in the future, if we can do much bigger sample size studies, like 3 times or 5 times the larger sample size studies, which is already actually happening now, then we can actually potentially improve the performance of the, like, for example, the AUC can jump from, like, you know, from, like, up to go, for example, 75% for a time. This is like type 2 diabetes, which is quite decent. But notice that what is happening is that with the increasing sample size, the expectation is that we will find more and more SNPs. And the genetic architecture of common diseases that we have observed is that it seems now that there are not tens, not hundreds, actually there are thousands of common SNPs which are related to each of these common diseases, each with small effects, but they potentially together has a very, could be a very potent factor to improve the discriminatory performance of the model. We just need to do this very, very big study that will lead to the discovery of these very, very small effects, but we'll find them in hundreds or even thousands. So there's a kind of a fact, like, you know, like, okay, one way to improve the performance of the risk prediction model, you know, taking advantage of the genetics would be to increase sample size. And so one of the things, like, you know, I'll cite this article where they did an interesting simulation study to see, I mean, would you expect that, you know, if you identify gene-gene and gene-environment interaction, they will likely to improve the performance of the risk prediction model. But you can think about, you know, gene-gene and gene-environment interaction as just another more risk factors, like you are adding more risk factors. And what this paper tried to show that if you be realistic, okay, that if you think that, okay, it's unlikely there will be qualitative interaction, that, you know, that you might have an environment that is actually reversing the effect of the gene. I mean, it would be realistic that, yes, there might be effect modification. And if you have effect modification, then you still expect some marginal effects. And so if you consider a model that you build based on only the marginal effects versus a model taking into account interaction, then at least in terms of the discriminatory power performance, you don't expect much, gain under those realistic model of simulations. But one still have to be very careful that that's sort of about a statement about the discriminatory performance of the model, but one still have to be careful about the calibration, which I said is a distinct concept. That inclusion of those terms, the interaction terms, or finding the interaction term may not improve the discriminatory performance of the model, but you still may want to model them carefully so that you at least make sure that you get an unbiased estimate of risk. Like, for example, people who have the gene and who have been exposed, we want to produce an unbiased estimate of risk in the population, and if you ignore interaction terms, even they are small, you might underestimate or overestimate the risk of certain people. So the rest of my talk, I'm going to talk about a little bit about this architecture of joint effects, like, you know, gene-gene or gene-environment interactions, and then what's the implications for risk stratification and disease prevention. So I will be describing some work, empirical work, which we are doing using data from a large case control studies, all drawn from a series of cohort studies involving 17,000 cases and about 20,000 controls. And we will try to build a model for risk for breast cancer using all known risk factors for this disease, including the various lifestyle and anthropometric and environmental risk factors, and actually SNPs, like the SNP that has been discovered through genome-wide association studies. In this particular study, actually, there are 24 SNPs that have been genotyped, that has been already associated with the risk of the breast cancer. But to date, actually, the number of SNPs that are known for breast cancer is actually now reached to at least 76. And so we are able to do some modeling to sort of, even though they were not genotyped yet, because we know that what is the odds ratio of these SNPs and what is the allele frequency of these SNPs, we can come up with an estimate of risk and put them in this model and to see what would be the performance of this model. So some of these things have begun to appear, but I'll go over some of this work here. So here are some key steps for us to develop a full model for predicting absolute risk for breast cancer that integrates all information about known risk factors. The first part, that's what I'm going to focus on, is that basically the construction of the genetic risk score. That means how this multiple SNPs in combination acts on the risk of the disease. And then once we do that, then we also wanted to see like how this genetic risk score acts in conjunction with other risk factors. That means that's where it comes with like the modeling gene-gene and gene-gene interactions. And then there are three other steps. Like we use the data to come up with a good model for relative risk, and then we combine information from SEER to get an estimate of absolute risk, and then we use data from like the National Health Survey data, such as like enhance, like to project what would be the distribution of risk for the U.S. Population. But today I'm going to focus on this part, like what's the good model for the genetic risk scores, and how that genetic risk score might act with the other risk factors, and what are the implications for that for disease prevention. So whenever we want to model interaction, the first thing we want to ask the question, what's the scale we are talking about interaction? Is it I'm going to model in the logistic scale, or the probit scale, or just in the linear scale? We want to model interaction, that way that there's interaction in the linear scale. But even before telling you a lot about the data analysis, so far if you look at the literature about all the G by E interaction analysis that has happened in using very large sample size studies, there seems to be very little evidence of either gene-gene interaction or gene and Y interaction in the logistic scale. Like if you look at the interaction in the logistic scale, people with very large studies, they have not seen much evidence of interactions. And of course there is still a question of power. Although these studies are big, so it could be a part of this could be lack of power. But it's also possible that the risks are at least close to being multiplicative. And so, but for our purpose, we are not actually so much interested in actually modeling, identifying gene-gene interaction. Our goal was to see, can we come up with a good model that describes the overall risk? And what we got worried was that, yes, it's possible that, we have small interactions between multiple genes and multiple environments that we are not being able to detect for our sample size. But if many of these interactions exist, then it's possible that when you go to the extremes of the risk, people who are at high risk, if they have many combination of the SNPs, that the model is actually misspecified, because those small deviations might start actually getting magnified and near the extremes of disease risk, and that's very important because those are the people who will get affected most, because the people who are at high risk are extremely high risk, or people who are at extremely low risk, when they get their estimate, they might make decisions, and you want to make sure that at that extreme, the model is well calibrated. And the standard, way of testing gene-gene-gene interaction, if you do that and then you make conclusion, no, you didn't find any interaction, so the model must be good, that may not be the right strategy here. So as an example, I'll for example talk about testing the adequacy of two models. One is the standard linear logistic model that assumes that the multiple markers act linearly in the logistic scale, versus the linear additive model that means they actually act additively in the linear scale. Okay, so this is afraid of, this is a result of a conversion from PowerPoint to PDF, but you have to bear with me. So what I'm showing is that in this axis, the number of risk alleles people carry at 19 different single nucleotide polymorphisms. And if you follow the red line, that's sort of what we expect under a linear logistic model, because that's a linear line, and I'm plotting the log odds ratio scale. Okay, so the red line is what you'd expect if the logistic regression is correct. And the black dots are sort of the empirical risk. If I put people into categories based on this combination of SNPs, and if I plot the empirical odds ratios, that's sort of the actual risk follows. And then the black line, that's a smoother that is sent through that, that dots. So you can see that there is in the main part of the data, that where the most of the data is, the center, the red and the black line actually is pretty good. They're fitting very well. But you start seeing departure near the tail. That's what I was worried about, is that, and standard goodness of fit test, which is the power is driven by where the data lies. which is the center. But what I, here I'm interested in actually to actually detecting departure near the tail, because that's where, you know, some of the, if you have important departure, and that's where, you know, the clinical decisions will matter. So what he suggested was that, you know, come up with an alternate goodness of fit test that to improve the power of detecting the departure near the tail. Very simple idea. Again, bear with me the plots, the lines. So what he said, okay, like, you know, in goodness of fit test, you look at model residuals and sum it over all the people. But instead of that, they said, let's choose some thresholds, you know, and that the high risk threshold and the low risk threshold. And then look at the model residuals only on those people who are above certain high risk or who are lower than certain low risk. And then you can think about what is the, you can construct a test statistic. But then, you know, of course, then there's a, you have some arbitrariness, you have to choose a particular threshold. So what you do is that you actually choose different thresholds, and then you maximize the test statistics over all possible thresholds, so that it is not actually depend strongly on the choice of the threshold. So that's what the, you know, the, we come up with a new goodness of fit test statistics that actually improves the power for detecting model departure at near the tails of disease risk. And that's the mathematical formulation of just what I showed in the figure, that you look at standard model residuals, but in these tail regions, but then you make the test statistic more robust to the choice of the threshold by choosing, you know, a grid point of threshold and then maximize it over the different thresholds. Okay, so now if we apply that to the breast cancer and data, and so, like, you know, and we try to see, okay, how good a additive model fits versus a logistic model, you know, linear logistic versus linear additive. And so what the main thing is that if you look at additive model, and, you know, we tried the tail-based test and then also some standard goodness of fit test, like, you know, Hirschman-Lomasha. And what one thing is very clear, that doesn't matter what test you're using, the additive model could be clearly rejected. I mean, this has more power that the tail-based test, but even standard test is actually will clearly reject it. That means you can, like, safely say that you know, the additive model in the linear scale is not a good model to describe the effect of the combination of the SNPs. But if you look at the multiplicative model or linear logistic model, we found that even with the more powerful test, we could not reject that multiplicative model. So if you remember the figure, that the departure is short near the tail, that could be easily due to the uncertainty in the data. And we confirmed that even with a more powerful test, that could not be rejected, which was quite interesting. So what we found was that the multiplicative model could not be rejected even with a large data set. That means when I say multiplicative model is linear logistic and a powerful method. And so far at least it seems like the fit seems even adequate even at extremes, and still we cannot rule out modest departures because of the power. And we could soundly reject the additive model. That, in other words, that there's a plethora of gene-gene interaction in the additive scale, which is not surprising. If the multiplicative model holds, you'd expect the additive interaction. There is evidence of additive interaction. But does it matter clinically? Okay. So what is the difference between statistically you understand the difference, but what does it make matter clinically? So what it means is that if the multiplicative model holds, there is actually stronger risk variation in the population than the additive model. So let me go back to the figure. The red line is the multiplicative model. And then the blue line is the fit under the additive model. So you can see that, you know, under the multiplicative model, there will be more variation in the risk than the additive model. It's more plateau. So, for example, if you look at a quantity, like, you know, proportion of the population that would be identified at, let's say, twofold or higher than the average risk in the population. So, if you fit the additive model, and, you know, if that was the correct model, you'll actually only identify only 2.02% of the population who is above average by twofold than the average risk. But under the multiplicative model, which is a more accurate model, you'll get a very, you know, it's still a small number, but in terms of percentage, the amount of people will identify is vastly different. And it will not capture this. If you look at it in terms of, for example, the area under the curve or discriminatory performance, this is all related to calibration. If you look at in terms of area under the curve or the, you know, the discriminatory performance of the model, they'll be relatively similar. Like, you know, for example, the correlation in the polygenic risk score under the two model is 0.93, and the area under the curve is actually pretty similar, because the area under the curve doesn't say anything about the calibration. It is all about, you know, how well the two samples could be separated. So that's sort of, you know, the so you are like confident with the you know, the linear logistic model for the combination of SNP effects, and then we applied a similar technique to see whether the SNP and the environmental risk factors act multiplicatively, and we again found that they relative, you know, they actually act pretty multiplicatively or additively in the logistic scale. So now we put all of them together, and so you can see like now that if you, for example, use a model like Gale model, this is actually slightly better than Gale model because it has few more risk factors. You get an area under the curve about 59%. Just the SNPs alone, like the 77 SNPs, will get you a area under the curve of 61%, and then the if then put them together, they'll give you around area under the curve of 64%. And this is the actual distribution of absolute risk in the U.S. population. So, you know, these include information about the baseline risk available from the NCICR rate, but then we project it using the distribution of risk factors available from the, you know, the NHANES. So it is actually projected for the whole of U.S. Population. So you can see, like, you know, the different highlighted, like, what proportion of the, you know, like, population is above certain threshold. These have been identified. For example, using this model, we can currently identify 1.5% of the people whose, you know, 30 to 70 year risk is above 20%. But one of the things we wanted to do was that as part of this exercise, like, you know, how much is this variation in risk is due to modifiable factors versus non-modifiable factors? Because, you know, the non-modifiable factors, like including in your genetic, we cannot do anything about it. So what we wanted to understand was that what part of this variation is actually could be changed. Okay. So what we did was that, so we categorized people by their deciles of what I consider non-modifiable risk, which includes the SNPs and few other factors like height, and, you know, we consider reproductive risk factors at this point is non-modifiable for women. And then we show the variation in risk, in absolute risk, due to the modifiable factors, and which we had four modifiable factors: alcohol, BMI, HRT use, and smoking. And so if you do that, and if you look at absolute risk variation, the what striking feature is that the spread in absolute risk due to the modifiable factors is much stronger, much larger for people who are at high non-modifiable risk than people who are at low non-modifiable risk. And this is expected, I mean, in a mathematically, because under a multiplicative model, you expect, you know, more risk differences if your baseline risk is high. But the point is how much additional spread you are seeing, and you can see that there's a pretty clear, pretty strong variation here. And so, in a way, it is interesting. Like, for example, like, even people who are, let's say, 9th or 10th decile of non-modifiable risk, like, for example, you get genetic tests and your risk is 80%. Okay, it's pretty high. But if you look at that, if you do not smoke, if you're low BMI, if you do not use HRT, and you have all the four good things, then your risk is sort of average as the U.S. population risk. So that perspective, I think, like, found was it as encouraging that, you know, that, like, even if your modifiable risk, even if your risk is high due to your genetics, if you do few good things, you at least could bring down your risk sort of at an average U.S. population level. 2 minutes. Okay. And so we said, okay, but that's good for individual counseling, but suppose we wanted to talk about, you know, targeted intervention. Like, you know, okay, so suppose we have a strategy to target these women based on their non-modifiable risk, and, you know, and think about what's the proportion of the disease that will prevent if we could actually remove or, you know, bring people to do the right thing in each group separately. And we had some algebra, but I'm not going to go through the algebra. But what I'll show is that currently we estimate, like, if, like, again, from attributable risk calculation, so this is not causal effect, these are all estimated from, you know, observational epidemiology studies, bearing that in mind, that if, you know, if everybody sort of, you know, did the right thing, that means they did the behavior in terms of the four non-modifiable risk factors, the right thing, we can potentially prevent 28% of breast cancer in the U.S. population. But if you think about, like, okay, what percentage of those preventable breast cancers comes from the different categories of non-modifiable risk about which they cannot do anything, but that could be potentially used to target women, you will see that, yes, in principle, actually, there are a higher fraction of that preventable diseases comes from people who are at high non-modifiable risk. For example, in the quintile 5, 33% of that, you know, 28.2% comes from the quintile 5 compared to only 10% comes from quintile 1. Okay, but one thing to keep in mind that if I just target the quintile 5, I'll still miss a significant fraction of the preventable breast cancer. So the message is that we need to keep continuing the general prevention effort. We cannot just concentrate on these high-risk people. But for individual counseling, or if there are some interventions which are going to be very expensive, or it has, you know, other harmful effects, then this group might be targeted. But that does not mean this group is, for the general purpose, more or less benign and less expensive intervention effort that needs to continue at the population level, because, you know, that this, there is a spread here. So all groups have a substantial number of preventable breast cancer. But for economic purpose, if you have some expensive intervention, then, and you cannot apply to the whole population, then you might want to start from this group. With that, I think I will conclude. So that a couple of key conclusions, that the multiplicative model for gene-gene and gene-y interaction actually works well. That means the logistic regression, the good old logistic regression works amazingly well. Even at extremes of disease risk, where I expected a priori that, you know, things will start falling apart. But we need to keep monitoring the tail, because that's where a lot of the clinical decisions will be made. And because we have small number of people in the current studies, we need to have large studies to, you know, observe those, you know, people at extreme risk. And the multiplicative model has a very important risk stratification, you know, because I showed that, you know, that the under that multiplicative model, how, you know, the amount of stratification you get from a modifiable factors is hugely varied by the non-modifiable factors, and that has implications for targeted interventions and strategies like that. And evaluating area under the curve, okay, that how much the genetic risk would added on top of the environmental risk would not give anything about that. It's just can be very misleading. So those are my key messages. With that, I think I'll end.